This is a podcast called Walk, Talk, Listen. An attempt to connect people and make this world a bit better by sharing opinions and experiences based on the belief that everyone's perspective is true, albeit partial. My name is Maurice Bloem, and I would like to welcome you to yet another episode of Walk, Talk, Listen. And delighted again that I've an awesome guest today. There's my colleague who worked for Bread for the World until recently, David, and he will introduce himself. David, why don't you go ahead?
I'm David Beckman. I'm now President Emeritus of Bread for the World, also President Emeritus of the Alliance to End Hunger, which is its secular counterpart. And I was just appointed to a joint fellowship at the Berkeley School of Public Policy and the Graduate Theological Union there. So that's me.
Yeah, wow. And it will be quite a change for, you know, both institutions, Bread for the World as well as the Alliance, because you have been there for so many years and you really... you have done great, great work, and it was always a pleasure for me to work with you as the representative of Church World Service in those occasions. So many thanks for what you stand for and what you've done, David. Can you tell a little bit on how you got involved in the, you know, on where you are now?
Actually, I think, my parents were about Christian people, and they lived it. We went to a conservative Lutheran church. But my dad was really committed to civil rights in Nebraska.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I promote anti-racism work among his relatives and other folks in Nebraska way back. And my mom taught a sewing class for low-income women in Lincoln, Nebraska. So I had that background. And then when I went to college in the late 60s, really the anti-Vietnam War movement and the Black Power movement woke me up. I was a student and had some exposure to those movements, and they made me realize, whoa, we've got big problems here. And so after college, my college gave me a fellowship to travel around the world. I got to see countries, a lot of developing countries. And so that really shaped me. And then I went to seminary and economics, school in economics, and whole life has really been about poverty, God, and politics. Mm. Politics part comes because, in my view, the binding constraint on progress against poverty is the weak political will. And so that's what I've spent my life working on and continue to work on that. And the spiritual underpinnings of why is that? Why is a country that's very religious, where maybe a quarter of the people are in religious services every weekend? You know, why do we show a pretty harsh face to people in need in our country and around the world compared to what other countries do?
Hmm. And in your search for the answer, you know, where are you within that?
Well, Church World Service is 75 years old. Bread for the World is 45 years old. But these institutions, in fact, were part of the early expression right after the Second World War of commitment to poor people around the world by many American churches and Jewish groups. At that time, it was mainly Jewish and Christian groups. And other people of goodwill through an organization like Oxfam, those were secular organizations. But that I think all that effort, you know, step by step, we feel like sending this $100 to this organization mm-hmm. is going to make any difference with these huge problems. But in fact, over the last 30 years, we've seen dramatic progress against hunger, poverty, and disease in developing countries. The pandemic is a huge setback, but it is not in any way undercutting the work of a generation. So I think we've learned, we've had some success. And part of that success is advocacy. I learned about advocacy from Larry Rasmussen, who was the first director of CWS's office in Washington. Mm. It was one of the first Washington offices that did advocacy. And so CWS and Bread for the World Together have been lobbying Congress for all their years, or at least the last 40, 45 years. And it's made a difference over the last 20 years, I think, U.S. foreign assistance has quadrupled. The good parts of U.S. mm-hmm. foreign assistance have quadrupled. And the quality's improved. And, you know, most of the progress has been achieved by people in the developing countries. But it has helped. A powerful country in the world during those years showed some real interest in supporting progress against hunger, poverty, and disease. Mm-hmm. We have reduced hunger, poverty, and disease in a massive way. So I think there's a lot to do. Obviously, we've got huge problems now. Mm-hmm. But, I believe in God. I think God's on our side. God wants this thing to happen. And we've seen a lot of progress, so we should keep it up.
I would like to piggyback a little bit on what you said that, you know, when you were studying and you started to look around, you know, driven by your parents who were also very religious, and you started to travel. If you look at the younger generation now and the way they look and perceive religion and spirituality, do you see a difference when, you know, when you was that age, and if so, how is it different? And if not, how is it similar? What are your observations and what are your lessons? What do you see within this?
Well, it's complicated, you know.
It's a whole PhD study, right?
I mean, every generation, we're diverse, you know, yeah. And so we have to be careful not to.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yes.
There. But as a broad trend, the nation, people in America have. It's a very religious, very church-going country, but has become less so. You know, there's been a pretty significant shift over the last 10 years, especially away from loyalty to particular church bodies or even to big traditions like Christianity. Are they Jewish? I mean, there's just less affiliation, less mm-hmm. loyalty to those broad labels. And it makes a difference. If people don't go to church, it makes a difference in their spirituality for good and for ill. I think I mentioned that I'm going to teach at Berkeley next term. And so that'll actually be a good chance for me to a fairly deep discussion with mm-hmm. a group of young leaders. There'll be people studying for careers in public policy and people studying for careers in religious leadership meeting together. But these mm-hmm. are that trend toward religious disaffiliation is strongest on the West Coast and strongest among young people. So I think I'll hear a lot from that group of people I'll learn more than I know now about what their spiritual lives are, and I think, yeah, I mean, it's clear that a lot of people who are disaffiliated from religious institutions, they still have very active religious lives, and you know, I think two-thirds of them say they believe in God. Mm-hmm. Them say they pray every day. This, you know, just when you do religious mm-hmm. service. So, the distinction between, and then what's also true is that of the people who go to church, there are a lot of people, many of those people say they don't experience God as a loving presence in their lives. They're in church, but they feel that God's remote or a judge. Whereas some of the religiously unaffiliated people say, oh yeah, I do experience God as a loving presence in my life. So there's change going on the other hand, maybe it's not so fundamental, or it's not so clear. It's not like, okay, you know, the sheep are on this side and the goats are on this side.
Mm.
I'm very affiliated. You know, I go to church. I go to church by Zoom now every Sunday.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a big difference in
I'm looking forward to going to community. I really miss going to communion every Sunday. I'm very affiliated with the Christian community and think there's a lot of power in that. Over the last week, I've been reading a book. It's focused on religion and public policy, public life in the Northwest of this country, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Alaska. And most of the people in that part of our country have never church, synagogue, or mosque, or temple. Mm. You know, it's the land of the nuns.
Yeah.
So I read it. I chose to read it for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a pretty good description there of the different ways that people who are not connected, who are not religiously affiliated in the sense of belonging to a church or identifying as a Christian, you know, what are the spiritualities of those people?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot to admire in terms of creativity, individualism, individual development, personal development, love of nature. On the other hand, I was struck that the editors of that book pointed to the fact that that people who mainline Protestants, Catholics, Reformed and Conservative Jews, and their organizations have played a disproportionate role in providing social services and also in political activism around issues of war and peace, poverty, racial justice, gender justice, environment too. So I think the experience of the grace of God, actually there's some data that show it helps people be concerned about changing government policies. If you believe that God has forgiven you over and over again, you are also more trusting of other people. And so, you know, if you're not so sure about that, then you're more inclined to just be limited to giving to food banks. Giving to food banks is really important, but you want somebody to be there to check that they don't pick up an extra bag of groceries. Whereas if you have that, a more overflowing spirituality, then you're more inclined to say, yeah, let them go to the grocery stores and buy their, you know, use food stamps, go to the grocery store, buy groceries. You know, so there's actually an empirical connection between the grace of God and certainly the gathering of people in ethical religious communities. There's a strong connection between that and being civically active and charitable. So I don't want to put down the old ways.
Would be interesting if you starting, you know, how that will inform then your view on the younger generation. Yes, absolutely. So we need to make another appointment in a couple of months. David, you know that, well, since 2012, I'm walking 100 miles in a week to raise awareness.
That's great.
Yeah, it has gone out of hand. I was only planning to do that one or 2 years.
The first time you told me, I thought, oh my gosh, that's all.
You know, if you would be asked to walk 100 miles, you know, for the cause, what would it be for?
It's just great that you do it, especially when you, this year you couldn't, but when you were able to visit crop walks and church world people along the way, it's a great way to kind of grow the crop walk into something kind mm-hmm. of a marathon. Just great. I'm walking quite a bit in the pandemic.
Yes. We should be all soon, right? Yeah. Yeah.
But it's just worked out that I really had one vocation since my whole adult life, mm-hmm. and that is to connect poverty, God, and politics. Mm-hmm. I experienced this thing of, you know, for me, it's rooted in God's embrace in Jesus. But then Pope Francis said that the grace of God gives us such joy that we want to change the world to make it more consistent with the fact that God loves everybody. It's a great line. It says it, you know, we're trying to change the world to make it more consistent with the fact that God loves everybody. And then it's just clear to me that it is, that in our time, that I think God has made it possible for us to get to the virtual end of hunger and poverty. You know, within a fairly short period of time, that's quite possible. And it's also quite clear that public policy is crucial. As important as voluntary work is, and it is really important, partly because of its impact on society more generally. So that's really important. But if the government is AWOL, you can't succeed. You can't get to the end of it. And in this country in particular, I think we tend to be pretty hard-hearted. We're privately generous and publicly stingy. My 100-mile walk is, working for a lifetime on helping us to be publicly generous, to build the organized give a damn that'll get the U.S. government to be a real partner with poor people in this country and around the world.
I'm listening to you. I'm kind of thinking about, you know, what do you think should be done? Because, you know that we, as a world, we signed up for the Sustainable Development Goals. And, you know, SDG2 is end hunger, SDG1 is end poverty, et cetera, et cetera. But the U.S. has, you know, first of all, it's not very known in this country, if you compare it to the rest of the world. And second, the actions has been really limited, to say the least. I think it's thanks to organizations like BRED that people know about, that we should work on this together. What do you, linking that again to your, what would drive you and what drives you, how do you think, what can we do? What can you do to move the SDGs forward within the U.S.?
I do think it's remarkable that that we had this international process. Lots and lots of people all over the world participated, and that the world, the nations of the world, all came to agree on a set that first that it is possible, that we've got big problems, but it is possible to virtually end poverty by 2030 and do it in a way that also makes our development more sustainable. So it's progress that can be sustained into the far future, and that's quite remarkable. I mean, the goals are, it's a long list of goals. It's not easy to read. It's not catchy.
No,
the world is complicated. Is complicated. Yeah. So, and the genius of it is that everything really is related to everything. So if you want to reduce hunger, you got to reduce war. Mm-hmm. You've got to improve environmental protection. You've got to deal with climate change. And if you want to deal with climate change, if people are hungry in Indonesia on the edge of the rainforest, as you know, they'll cut down the damn rainforest because mm-hmm. hungry, you know, they need to farm. And so they're not going to be protecting nature when they be able to feed their kids. So these goals are all interrelated. And I think the fact that they were adopted and the rest of the world, the U.S. is sort of an outlier. People are really aware of the goals. Governments are committed to the goals. In the U.S., our government during the Trump years, they sort of buried them. Although, you know, the U.S. is still part of the process of monitoring how are we doing every year. One thing that I love about this round of global goals is that they apply to the industrialized countries like the U.S. Mm-hmm. And they make a lot of sense in the U.S. Because the whole world is improving its ability to measure human welfare. Even in this pandemic, we have better measures. We have a more sophisticated set of metrics. We can know more about what's happening to human welfare. And so actually, when the Trump administration, Bread for the World, helped to set up a system of tracking sustainable development goals in the U.S., in the Office of Management and Budget of the U.S. government. We were afraid that they were going to get rid of it during the Trump administration. But the director of the OMB said, no, if anybody's going to measure those goals, it's going to be us. So they've maintained that effort. So actually, the Biden administration coming in, we'll see. I mean, that's not their first priority, but I think they will be more part of this international discussion. In terms of communicating the goals, I think you've got to make it, you've got to make it simple. So one way to do that is to, what Bread for the World has done is just to promote the idea that it's possible to end hunger by 2030. Easier for people to get than this whole complex system of goals. So by picking out one goal, that would be one way to simplify it so that people can grasp what it's about. But it isn't, it is... basically, it's about hunger, poverty, environment together, and working on all those things together with an realizing that we have urgent problems and also have great possibilities. And then also doing it as a world. You know, you can't solve these problems as one country, even a big country. We've seen that. You know, right now, I mean, with the pandemic. As the U.S. has, the U.S. Congress and the President have appropriated money to deal with the pandemic, only 0.2% of the money that they've allocated for this global pandemic is going to any international activities. You can't solve a global pandemic. I mean, we haven't done a good job within our own borders either, but we're not going to get to the end of this if the U.S. isn't providing support for international efforts to deal with the pandemic and the economic shutdown in places like Honduras and Uganda. So I think those goals are not dead. We'll see how they go. It depends a lot on what President-elect Biden decides to do, but I think his administration will participate in international discussions of the goals. And if we can get the if we can get the political will, if we can remobilize the political will, even that we had a few years ago, what happens in the U.S. politics is a big part of that. If we get that kind of political will in our country and then in many other countries around the world, we could make progress on these goals pretty quickly. On the hunger goal in the U.S., I think in 5 years, virtually end hunger in America.
And when I'm listening to you, two things come to mind, actually. I mean, one is, you need to be applauded for that. As the leader of Bread, what you have been able to do is bring bipartisanship to these issues, right? And so even during these last 4 years, what you always continue to do is try to see where you can love the other, why you with whom you might not agree, you know, and to start the conversation. Right. That's what I kind of hope with this podcast as well, to show is that nobody can be wrong all the time. So, you know, wait until there is something where you can start to dialogue.
Right. And on the international poverty issues, there are strong leaders mm-hmm. on those in both parties in the U.S. Congress. Yeah. It has been, in Washington, there's an faith coalition on foreign assistance, as you know, that has participated in, as part of a broader, really pretty strong constituency for doing the right things about global poverty, refugee, mm-hmm. all those issues. And surprisingly, international assistance has increased, U.S. international assistance has increased somewhat mm-hmm. in the Trump years, not as part of the COVID response, but until then, that group of Republican and Democratic leaders in Congress, supported by a lot of people of faith and other people of goodwill, mm-hmm. We've been able to be, as a nation, somewhat responsive to hunger and famine in some of the places where CWS works. Mm-hmm. But it helps to have U.S. government can cut big checks. So
you're right. Absolutely.
And provide some support for CWS too, to complement mm-hmm. what your generous supporters give. It's a tribute to it's one of the clearest examples of bipartisanship mm-hmm. that continues despite all the things that are tearing us apart.
Yeah. No, you're right. And then the other thing that while I was listening to you, you mentioned climate change, you know, so much related with hunger and poverty issues, if not, you know, the most important thing. But there, you know, going back to the discussion that we had about the young generation, well, there the young generation is the leading generation. I mean, they are, you know, so maybe that makes the circle round in terms of how this all works.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. What are some of the things that you worry about, you know, that are going on in the world today? And then related to that is, where do you see still the hope in, you know, that, you know, that we are moving forward and that we are making this world a bit better?
I think, let me start with the hope, because mm-hmm. I think what Church World Service has helped to do over the last generation is a huge reason for hope. Mm-hmm. In 1990, the World Bank estimates that there were 2 billion people in absolute poverty in the world. That's now down to about 700 million. So a little bit more than a third. Even though the population of the world has increased, people in absolute poverty has been dramatically reduced. The World Bank estimates that another 100 million people have been pushed into poverty this year. So that's a lot of suffering. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you sort of stand back and see, what did we help to make happen over the last 30 years? We have tremendous reason to think that we can get on top of this pandemic and that we can restore progress. We've learned a lot over those 30 years about how to get further. So, The progress that we have made and that Church World Service has in many ways led, seems to me that progress is a big reason for hope. Another reason, I mean, there are religious reasons. You can just think into this. I think our Creator has built into all living things resilience and adaptability. Mm. It's really remarkable. You know, it's in... I mean, we call it hope, but as you know, people who are extremely poor and in terrible situations still think, well, you know, I've got this idea. I'm going to try this. And So I think, you know, that resilience that's been built into humankind, the fact that we want to hope, that we're looking for hope, the reason for hope. And then on the worry side, I really do think that the biggest problem that the world, Jeffrey Sachs just wrote an essay that I read a couple of days ago, mm-hmm. and he's at Columbia University. Mm-hmm. And,
yes.
But he said that the decline of rational politics in the United States is the world's biggest problem. And I think that's true. I think the elections have moved us in the right direction, but not very far. And anyway, the problems that have emerged over the last few years are not because of one man. The body politic in this country has real problems, real ailments. And I think some of them go back to spiritual ailments. Some of that's within the churches. I'm a preacher, so the scriptures are clear that the fact that you say, Lord, Lord, that doesn't necessarily please God. It's then, what do you do? What do you do with that? And so I don't mean to be judgmental, but I do think it's clear that the body politic is sick and we need to pray. And, you know, within the country, at least when it comes to politics, we tend to be mean to each other. And we're especially mean to people who are a different color or don't have much money, or we think they're lazy. I mean, it's just, there's a meanness toward vulnerable people that is especially, all of us who've got a stake in this, we have to change. You know, some of it is that we've divided ourselves by income and level of education and race. So we don't live together anymore as much as we used to. I mean, we've always been divided, but there's a sharper division so that it's easier to think ill of somebody that you don't see at the grocery store. And you don't know his name, you know, you don't know. But anyway, I think the thing that most concerns me, the thing I think we need to pray about and work to change is the healing of the U.S. body politic.
Mm. We're slowly coming to an end. Is there any last message that you have for the listeners of this podcast?
Oh, sure. Sure. Continue your support for Church World Service. seriously. Yeah. It's a great organization. It's working on the toughest problems in the world. It's helping to empower poor people in very, very tough situations. So continue what you're doing. Step up your contributions if you can. That's my word. Sure. And if you want to walk 100 miles on top of it, great. Do that. But keep the money coming in.
Thank you so much, David. Thank you so much. And just for the listeners, I did not bribe David into saying this.
No. But the money's important. Money is energy. Money is going to do things. So, and you know, in our own lives, the money is that, you know, that's what we want to use that for our vacation, or, you know, to maintain our own families. But sharing your money, sharing your energy through an organization like Church World Service is a big part of the solution. And also Church World Service is very important, is an active in advocacy in the U.S. on the immigration issue, on foreign assistance issues. They're a strong voice. They're saying the right thing, and it's connected with their experience every day in some of the poorest places, the most desperate places in the world. And they bring folks from those places to meet with our members of Congress, to meet with people in the U.S. government. So just in terms of, you know, dealing with the ailments in the body politic, support for Church World Service is also a good way to help.
Well, thank you so much for your time, David, and your stories, your knowledge, and your willingness to share that with us today.
Well, you know, I'll pitch my website. It's www.david.com. www.jeffcoleman.net. But for the folks who sign up for my website, that'll be one way that I'll make some of the course available online. Mm-hmm. I'll be able to bring some other speakers, to speak to the students and talk with them, answer questions or have discussions with them. So those sessions, these will be national leaders at the nexus of poverty, God, and politics. A lot of what my website's going to be about the next, the coming months will be what I'm learning together with these, this next generation of leaders at the School of Public Policy and the Church Divinity School of the Pacific at Berkeley.
Great. So thanks a lot.
Thank you for all you do. Thank you, Maurice.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Walk, Talk, Listen. Please check us out on www.100mile.org or follow us on Facebook or Instagram.